Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now, we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Happy New Year. This is the first episode of 2025, I believe. But before we go any further, tell me if you've heard something like this before. Think of your body as a high-performance car. Just like you wouldn't expect your Ferrari to run on an empty tank, your body can't perform miracles without enough fuel. When athletes don't eat enough, things start to go haywire. Your hormones throw a tantrum, your body's systems start acting like they're on a coffee break, and your athletic performance, well, it takes a nosedive faster than a failed Olympic dive. It's like trying to run Netflix, Photoshop, and a dozen Chrome tabs on a laptop with 2% battery. Something's got to give. And yet, there's a paradox in the world of exercise science. Folks can somehow pull off incredible feats even when running on empty. It's like watching a Tesla break distance records with the low battery light flashing. The science shows that even when athletes aren't getting enough calories, we're talking about serious long-term energy shortages here, their bodies still find a way to adapt. And in this podcast, we're going to be discussing how to train when losing weight, including how weight loss affects strength, muscle mass, and conditioning, how to adjust exercise training when losing weight, and much, much more. On the other end of the line, we have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, dude?
Hey, I'm doing all right. Excited for the new year. I'm recovering from a little bit of an illness recently, but still been training and things are actually feeling good this week. So I'm excited. And this is the start of yet another of our recurring series of podcast episodes. It feels like we have a bunch of them at this point, whether our Q&As, our research reviews, the mystery cases, research reviews, lots of other kind of recurring episodes that we tend to do. And this past week, I got a couple messages, questions about training towards particular goals. And that kind of inspired the idea for, I guess, what this series will potentially become, kind of self-contained episodes on how to train towards a particular outcome goal, with the idea being that ideally we can make these episodes kind of like a self-contained one-stop shop for a particular goal. And so that might be something related to strength performance. It might be related to, you know, how to PR your mile run or a rowing effort, or I might, you know, riff on some swimming tips or any other performance goal or, you know, other very practical training situation, how to approach training in that situation. And so if people from the audience have particular goals that they're interested in pursuing, whether, you know, routine or potentially more unique goals, send them our way and we'll consider, you know, whether we want to put a podcast episode together on that with our own thoughts, or we might pull some of our friends, some of our colleagues, some other experts in the space on to talk about how they approach training towards very particular goals. And so I think the start of the new year, it's, you know, fitting, unsurprising, a common, you know, training oriented that you selected for this first one, how to train in the context of weight loss, and then we'll tackle some other goals in the near future.
Yeah, this was also a bit cathartic for me because we get a lot of these, they're like leading questions, particularly around weight loss and training. It's like, well, if I'm losing weight, you know, I shouldn't be training for strength, right? And you're like, well, why would you not do that? You know, so
usually not a great way to frame a question anyway.
Yeah, if you have to put right, if you have to put right at the end, yeah, maybe not so good. So I just thought, hey, it is the beginning of the new year. A lot of people are interested in losing weight That is true. You know, if somebody wants to do that, we're in support, provided you know, they check all the boxes as far as being a good candidate for weight loss. And yeah, this is the Barbell Medicine Podcast. So we got to talk about training during periods of weight loss and kind of like what happens and what we would expect. Also, I just want to point out that your excited voice is not particularly exciting. I just want to, when you said, "I'm really excited," oh boy, what happens when he's not excited?
I'm excited for the series. I think there will be other topics for which I'll be more enthusiastic. This was your baby to tackle. Maybe when
Fair
we
enough.
Talk about training towards, you know, PRing your swim, or if I PR a running effort, or at which time comes that I'm ready to PR a deadlift again, I'll be more hyped. But
there you go. All right. Well, yeah, let's kick this off with the sort of just background, like how to lose weight. I think most people who are listening to our podcast, you know, we've talked about energy balance before and a number of other factors related to people's dietary patterns, the food environment, whatever. So this might be review for some folks. But if you're just joining us for the first time, or maybe you really wanted to hear an overview of like how to lose weight, well, here you go. So when we talk about losing weight, we kind of always go back to energy balance, which represents one of the fundamental principles of human metabolism. This physiological mechanism measures the relationship between calorie intake, that's the energy we get from food and drink, and calorie expenditure, which occurs through basic metabolic processes and physical activity. Now, when calorie intake exceeds expenditure, the body stores this surplus energy typically as adipose tissue or body fat. Conversely, when intake and expenditure are equal, the body weight remains stable. During periods when calorie expenditure surpasses energy intake, the body draws upon its own energy reserves, resulting in weight loss. Understanding this metabolic equation is essential for managing body weight. Now, there are people out there who disagree with this. They're like, oh, look, calories in, calories out. That's not legit. And so the next question is, well, do you have any evidence where energy balance does not actually predict weight trajectory? And to date, there's really only one medical condition where that sometimes happens, which is kind of its own separate case that we may address on the podcast specifically. But otherwise, there aren't people who are gaining body mass while eating in an energy deficit. And just like there aren't people who are not gaining body mass who are eating in an energy surplus, just by definition. So the effect of energy balance on body weight takes place over a long period of time. We're talking many weeks and months, not hours or days. People get wrapped up in like, oh, well, I overate yesterday, so today, what should I do? And it's like, no, we're looking at a more longer scale of the reckoning, if you will, for dietary pattern. And there's also a greater than five-fold variability in the response to the same energy deficit or surplus between individuals, which is mostly attributed to genetics. That means that you can give people the same energy deficit or the same energy surplus, and they will not lose or gain the same amount of weight, unless they are identical twins, in which case we see that. But outside of that particular example, people will vary wildly in their response to an energy deficit or surplus. So to summarize, meaningful, sustainable weight change takes time spent in either an energy deficit or surplus, and the results often vary significantly between individuals. For weight loss, an energy or calorie deficit is key, and this can be created through a diet by eating less, or through activity by exercising more, or both. Now, there are two main reasons why increased physical activity, increased exercise is not our predominant or favored method for weight reduction, especially in those who are already active. Now, again, this is the Barbell Medicine Podcast. We are big fans of exercise, including those that don't involve barbells, believe it or not. But the reason why we favor using a more diet-centric approach rather than increased physical activity, especially for those who are active, is because it doesn't work that well. So these two main reasons. First, energy expenditure is usually compensated to some degree by reduced metabolism and reduced non-exercise activity, but also by an increase in energy intake, so that individuals tend to remain in energy balance. So if you take a person like Austin and you said, hey, look, I want, you know, you should, you know, do an extra 60 minutes per week of cardiorespiratory exercise, so endurance training, to lose weight, what his body would do to some degree in response, he would likely become a little hungrier on average and likely consume more calories, and other non-exercise activity sort of calories would go down. So whether that's because he's moving around less otherwise, whether it's because some of his other sort of metabolic processes slow down or become more efficient, the body is very, very good at sort of maintaining energy balance, and it seeks that energy balance. Okay, so that's one reason. The second reason is that the energy expenditure from increased exercise just isn't that much. It would take a lot more training time to burn enough calories that aren't otherwise compensated for to produce significant weight loss. We've seen this in some really interesting study designs. So for example, women who were training for and then actually completed a marathon, they doubled their running volume, for example. And you would expect, well, look, they doubled their running volume. Now they're like, you know, dozens of kilometers per week in training mileage. Yeah, well, they didn't actually lose any additional weight because, again, the body is sort of smarter than we are. And these are just a few of the reasons why increasing exercise and exercise only interventions for weight loss don't do that well for weight loss when compared with diet or exercise and diet combined. You can look at the scientific literature. There's a bunch of sources that I put in the show notes that will kind of support this. But the predicted amount of weight loss from X amount of calories being burned during exercise just doesn't pan out. And again, lots of variation between individuals. But generally speaking, the body tends to compensate on multiple levels to sort of reduce the deficit that you would otherwise create from just exercise only. So that brings us to our first takeaway or first set of recommendations. We recommend increasing exercise activity for those who are currently insufficiently active and who are able to participate in exercise in order to achieve at least the current physical activity guideline minimums. From there, the majority of weight management will be dependent on diet-induced energy restriction. For those who prefer calorie and or macronutrient targets, I've linked our free calorie and macronutrient calculators in the show notes. And we also acknowledge that adherence to an energy restricted diet can be challenging. So we further recommend focusing on modifying the food environment wherever possible. So reducing access to high calorie, ultra processed foods with added sugar at home, in the workplace, and so on, while increasing access to things like fruits, vegetables, and lean protein. We also recommend planning meals ahead of time so that you're prepared as well as being flexible. There's no need to be perfect with every detail, but rather stacking small wins over time is likely to pay off. But again, we acknowledge that adhering to any sort of dietary pattern can be challenging. Austin, any additional takeaways from like how to lose weight? I feel like covered the bases, but I might have missed something.
Yeah, I mean, for a 5-minute overview that is necessarily going to be simplified and distilled down in various ways, I think that captures a lot of the essence of it. I wouldn't want people to come away with the idea that exercise is irrelevant or unhelpful or should not be pursued here. I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that when we look at data on as far as an intervention or some sort of a tool at a population level, it might not be terribly impressive. This, you know, people will similarly talk about the difference between how BMI performs on a population level versus how it performs on an individual level, right? Kind of in the other direction. BMI is like pretty good on the population level, might be a little bit less good on an individual level. Here, it's like, okay, well, when we look at exercise interventions alone for weight loss on a population level, not that good. Whereas on an individual level, some people might find that, hey, it works great for them. Maybe they are genetically wired up such that when they ramp up their exercise activity, it doesn't tend to have a stimulating effect on their appetite. Maybe they respond through no, you know, choice of their own by their appetite being a bit more suppressed. And maybe it makes it easier for them to adhere to a calorie restricted diet. So there's a lot of individual variation here. And so exercise firmly has a role in, you know, body weight, body mass, body fat management. But I think that if anybody is purporting to claim that, hey, you don't really need to change much else about your life, but just, you know, get a little more activity in, I think that the likelihood that that is going to achieve what we'll call clinically significant long-term sustained weight loss on its own without changing much else, you know, broadly speaking, not super likely. There may be some edge cases here and there, but not going to be the primary lever we would pull, even though this is a necessary and strongly recommended part of weight management for everyone who is able to participate.
Yeah. When I think about exercise and weight loss and health, I think that exercise is a big lever to pull for like health promotion, and it helps support weight loss efforts. So you get, for example, better body composition, generally speaking, with weight loss compared to not exercising. You get people tend to be more sensitive to feelings of fullness, so the satiety signals. There tends to be less metabolic adaptation. And again, the health benefits of exercise, generally speaking, even without weight loss, cannot be overstated. So 10 out of 10 would recommend exercise. But as far as it being like the go-to intervention for weight loss, Like, I just imagine the scenario when someone is like, well, should I eat less or exercise more? You know, this false dichotomy. And it's like, I would prefer both probably. But if you're already meeting, and particularly if you're exceeding the current guidelines for exercise, I think the bigger lever to pull definitively is going to be dietary restriction. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely agree.
Cool. All right. So before we talk about designing an exercise program to support weight loss, let's take a closer look at what weight loss does to things like strength, muscle size, and cardiorespiratory fitness in response to exercise. We'll start with strength. Now, strength is muscular force production measured in a specific context. It is a function of structural inputs, such as muscle size, as well as neurological factors like coordination, how much muscle mass is recruited, and more. Overwhelmingly, strength gain and performance does not appear to be affected by modest calorie deficits. And I'll go through a little bit of the research here, but if you want to skip ahead probably 15 minutes, you can just take that to the bank and then move on to the next section. But some people are going to want a little bit more information to support the claim that eating in a modest energy deficit does not really affect people's strength response to training. So, for example, one study took 40 young, untrained men with overweight and subjected them to a large energy deficit, about 40% lower than their maintenance calories for 4 weeks, along with a lifting program and high-intensity interval training. After 4 weeks, their leg press strength increased by 98%, up like 340 kilos, which is 700 something.
Pretty good.
Their bench press strength went up to 32% increase. And I actually did check the study. I'm like, this is a Smith machine bench press, this is a hammer strength. By all accounts, it seems like it's a regular one rep max bench press. So pretty good. And their max push-up count went up by 32% despite this large deficit. Like if I told you, Dr. Baraki, hey, eat 40% less than what you've been eating to maintain your body weight. Again, you might have some sort of sense like, training may be compromised, or maybe my adaptation to training may be compromised. And sure, these people were untrained, but seemingly they were able to massively increase their strength. Oh, and by the way, their VO2 max also went up by 15%. We'll talk about that more specifically in a few sections to come. But this is just one of many studies that show this. There's another study of 24 untrained adults who were admitted to a research facility, so we actually know what they were eating, to eat a very strict diet for 2 weeks, either at energy balance, so maintenance level calories, that was the control group, or at a 750 calorie per day deficit. The group eating the deficit lost about 1.3 kilos over the 2 weeks, but there was no detriment in their muscle endurance, their muscular strength, their 5 mile run time, or Wingate test. That's a measure of anaerobic sort of capacity compared to that the people in the control group. So overwhelmingly, what we're seeing here is a sort of preservation of sort of physiological plasticity, to use some jargon here. It's like your body will adapt to exercise even if you're at a relative energy deficit. And the same is true even in athletes. The study of 24 elite Norwegian athletes who dieted using either a large or small energy deficit to achieve either fast or slow weight loss, fast weight loss being about a kilo per week and slow weight loss being about a half a kilo per week, both lost the same amount of body weight. It took the people doing the slow weight loss approach a little bit longer to do it. But the people in the slow weight loss group lost more fat mass, about 31%. Overall, compared to 21% in the fast weight loss group. Lean body mass actually increased by 2% in the slow weight loss group, was unchanged in the fast weight loss group. Their 40-meter sprint time was unchanged. Their one rep max squat increased similarly in both, and the one rep max bench press increased in both groups, although it did increase more in the slow weight loss group. Finally, a very recent meta-analysis of 52 studies that evaluated the effect of an energy deficit, so a calorie deficit, on lean body mass and strength results compared to eating at maintenance found that, and I'm quoting from the paper, strength gains were unaffected by the presence or absence of an energy deficit as well as its estimated severity. That subjects gained strength despite impaired gains or even losses of lean mass suggests that these strength gains may be independent of hypertrophy and instead due to neural adaptations or microarchitectural changes that typically precede detectable gains in lean body mass at the onset of a resistance training program. Pretty powerful quote there, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that reflects my thought listening to you cite the prior data, especially that in the untrained individuals, knowing that the rapid early strength gains that we see in a lot of training programs for untrained or insufficiently active folks a ton of that is neurologically mediated, which does not necessarily require, you know, laying down pounds and pounds of additional lean body mass that you would need from a calorie surplus over a period of time to accrue. And interestingly, as you mentioned, even one of the groups that was in a calorie deficit did manage to gain some lean mass, although you don't know that that's necessarily muscle mass. It could be other things, be it water, bone, organs, things like that, that can increase and fall in that category. But that a ton of neurological adaptation can occur even when you're in a calorie deficit is unsurprising. I think that, you know, if I had to come up with a way to push back against this claim in any way, it would be that, well, when we look at data on highly trained strength and power athletes, there's like a pretty strong correlation between their muscle cross-sectional area, like the size of their muscles and their performance when they're very, very highly trained, such that, you know, even if it's not entirely causal relationship between the two, but more of a correlational sort of thing, you know, if there was no relationship between the two, we wouldn't see that. And it seems like it would likely require developing, building some tissue over time, such that long-term losses in muscle cross-sectional area that we see in people who lose a ton of weight, that would be more likely to impair people who are very, very highly trained, elite level athletes over longer periods of time, for example. But I wouldn't be surprised if you're like, well, you could take an elite athlete and still they could be in a modest deficit for a few days or a week or even maybe a couple weeks or something like that before you start to notice decrements in performance. I would find that not surprising in the context of this other data. But eventually, I think the more trained you are, eventually the longer a deficit goes or the more severe the deficit goes, it might be more apparent compared with lesser trained people. That's my hunch.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I am fully supportive of the idea that the body is going to maximize or pull all levers available to it to like improve performance, you know, right? And so for strength in this particular case, in response to training, I would expect the body to, you know, leverage, to, pun intended, additional muscle mass. So it certainly applies and is certainly likely predictive of increased strength on some level. I just think that the correlation is, especially over time, is not as tight as people would expect. What people expect is that you gain a little bit of muscle mass, you gain a proportional amount of strength. And that is not always the case, which is why you can't really do just like a bodybuilding program, get bigger muscles, and then, oh shit, I'm stronger all of a sudden. No, that the additional muscle not only needs to be in the right places, but also well-trained to do the task that you're testing your strength on. And so just gaining, we'll call it like undifferentiated muscle mass through like leg extensions, for example, that may not, and I would like predict that it wouldn't carry over very well to your squat compared to more squat training that happened to result in additional hypertrophy. And the last thing I'll say, because we've kind of harped on this in various podcasts in the past, is that a good strength and conditioning program is likely to produce hypertrophy anyway. And so it's really hard to separate these things out. Like, oh, this is a purely hypertrophy focused program versus this is a purely strength focused program. You'd really have to do something like, okay, the strength program in this case is only 1 RM. You know, you're just doing one rep maxes all the time. And then the hypertrophy program has to be like blood flow restriction. And if you do that, you create this like artificial dichotomy. Well, not all blood flow restriction training is really, you know, shows a strength improvement, and not all like 1 RM only training shows a hypertrophy improvement, yet people get stronger with 1 RM training and then people get bigger with blood flow restriction training, but they don't necessarily get stronger. So there's some nuance there. If you're playing the drinking game at home, that, you know, take a shot. I would also maybe switch to like NA because there's got to be more mentions of the nuance in here.
Yeah, agree.
Cool. Yeah. And just the last thing I'll say about highly trained strength power athletes, there's relatively little data available on this, particularly when we're talking about like power lifters, Olympic weightlifters, stuff like that. There is data on MMA stuff, on you know, sprint athletes, on various other, we'll call them non-barbell sport athletes who are strength power folks like football players and such. But for the person who's listening to this, who's like, should I move up a weight class to get stronger? Yeah, I would predict the person's likely to be stronger moving up a weight class versus moving down a weight class if they're already trained specifically. But I don't know that they're more competitive in a higher weight class. That's a whole nother podcast topic we can talk about, like how to choose a weight class. Differences in strength outcomes for these highly trained sort of strength power athletes to me are mostly related to appropriate programming, individual responses to said programming, the magnitude of the calorie deficit. Is it large or small? Favoring small, probably doing better for these folks. And the duration of the deficit, short versus long. And I think short, general, would tend to do better. So that leads me to our second set of recommendations, our second takeaway here. We recommend continued resistance training during periods of energy restriction where the specifics of the lifting program are tailored to the individual, their current level of fitness, their goals, their preferences, and their subsequent response. We predict that people will be able to get stronger despite weight loss, particularly if the programming is good, the energy restriction is modest, so less than like a 500 calorie per day deficit, the rate of weight loss is slow, and or if the individual is untrained. Any issues with that takeaway, Dr. B?
Yeah, I think there's various permutations of that that can be, you know, effective for gaining strength despite weight loss. And definitely if all of those criteria are met, I think that the prognosis is quite good for somebody to gain quite a bit of strength, even if they're losing weight.
Prognosis. I concur, doctor. All right. So next, let's talk about muscle size, muscle hypertrophy in response to an energy deficit. Now, this is getting a lot of airplay on social media. I don't know. It's not just current, but like for a long time. So to start, from a health perspective, preservation of lean body mass is important during periods of weight loss and also for performance. Generally, when we think from like a mechanistic standpoint, we want equal rates of muscle protein synthesis and muscle protein breakdown to maintain lean body mass. And if we could get higher rates of muscle protein synthesis relative to muscle protein breakdown, well, we could likely accrue some muscle mass. Now, studies looking at muscle gain in individuals during dieting phases show a reduction in the rates of resting muscle protein synthesis, regardless of training status. But when it's combined with resistance training, muscle protein synthesis rates normalize and even elevate 30% higher than levels seen when consuming maintenance calories. This is often referred to as anabolic rescue. And so if you were just looking at this from like a mechanistic standpoint, you'd say, look, I can get even higher muscle protein synthesis rates if I'm in an energy deficit and then I train, compared to if I'm in an energy surplus and I train. So to gain the most amount of muscle mass, should I always be in an energy deficit? And it's like, so this is why you can't just focus on the mechanisms. You have to look at like outcome studies. So what actually happens to people's muscle mass?
Yeah. You also have to like keep your brain on like.
Yeah. What's that quote from Carl Sagan is like, keep an open mind, you know,
but just not make so sure. Open that your brain falls out. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Now, long-term studies on muscle gain during calorie restriction consistently show simultaneous increases in muscle mass and loss of fat mass in both untrained individuals and individuals with obesity. There's also some data showing that trained individuals can also gain muscle and lose body fat at the same time, particularly if they are good responders to training and if they're losing weight slowly. So for example, a group of elite Norwegian athletes recruited from a variety of different sports were randomized into either slow or fast weight loss groups. This is the same study we talked about earlier. The slow weight loss group followed a diet that resulted in a 0.7% decrease in body weight weekly, whereas the fast weight loss group lost 1.4% body weight weekly. The study ran for 12 weeks until the athletes reached the desired weight loss, which was a minimum of 4% decrease in body weight. Now, during the study period, both groups also engaged in resistance training 4 times per week. At the end of the study period, body weight decreased by about 5.5% in both groups, with the slow weight loss group losing a higher percentage of body fat compared to the fast weight loss group. Additionally, the slow weight loss group saw an increase in lean body mass by 2.1%. But to your point earlier, we're not sure if that's actual muscle, like contractile tissue, or if that's something that's just not fat. So it could be water, it could be bone, it could be visceral organs, although generally speaking, visceral organs tend to go down with body mass, but could be anything that's not fat.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that this is especially relevant to note because with a lot of the popular conversation going on right now that you alluded to earlier around the use of medicines like GLP-1 receptor agonists, you know, the data looking at what happens when people lose weight in the context of those medicines, or it could be in the context of other interventions like metabolic bariatric surgery, et cetera, people will use, you know, data and cite information around changes in lean body mass or changes in muscle mass or changes in fat-free mass. And these things can sometimes get conflated or not be delivered in terms of the messaging in a very clear way. And especially those who are, I guess, opposed to a lot of these interventions, they will tend to freak out and say, look at all of this muscle that people lost. And it's like, well, lean body mass is not the same thing as muscle. There are other things that go into that. And they may be kind of deliberately, or maybe if we're going to be more charitable, unintentionally kind of obfuscating the border between those, or the difference between them. And so that's something that should be broken down, and that terminology should be made very clear when you're talking about what happens to these various kind of body compartments. Is it fat mass, fat-free mass, muscle mass, bone mass, or body water? And then the error bars around the method of measurement itself should all be considered when you're looking at what's happening. What are people actually gaining? What are people actually losing in the context of these interventions?
Yep, agreed. Another study looking at 61 Division I football players during a 10-week winter conditioning period. Well, the average results for the players showed a decrease in body fat, that was measured by skin folds, and an increase in chest and thigh girths, a decrease in body weight, and increases in their one rep max squat and bench press performance. Seemingly, their legs got bigger, their chest got bigger, they lost weight, and they got stronger despite losing weight. So again, just sort of another little sort of token here for, yeah, people can still respond pretty well to training despite being in an energy deficit. And this is even true in older individuals. It was a study in 36 subjects ages 60 to 80 who were separated into a resistance training plus diet versus diet only group. And 6 months later, both lost similar amounts of weight, about 2.5 to 3 kilos, and similar amount of fat mass, about 2.5 kilos. But the lean body mass actually increased in the resistance training plus diet only group by about 0.5 kilo. To me, the 0.5 kilo, that seems to be smaller than the sort of error in measurement here. However, if we predicted that, look, just by and large, energy deficit as applied to individuals reduces their amount of muscle mass that they have or the amount of muscle mass that they gain from training, it doesn't seem to be completely abolished. And I think that's the main takeaway, that while we would predict that people will gain less muscle in an energy deficit when compared to energy balance, so eating at maintenance, or certainly an energy surplus, it's not that the whole response has been completely eliminated. And if you have favorable genetics, if you have a great program, if you're getting enough protein, I suspect that people will be able to gain muscle and lose fat at the same time. Not everyone, certainly, and not and certainly that sort of changes as people become more and more trained. But I think that's the general expectation that people should have. You should expect that you're going to gain a little bit of muscle mass and lose body fat at the same time until proven otherwise. How does that strike you?
Yeah, I agree. And this is super important. This actually comes up in conversations that I have with patients pretty often in two contexts. So one is the one that we've mentioned a bit so far, the use of weight loss medicines or metabolic bariatric surgery. When having conversations and consultations for folks who are interested in pursuing those things, especially if they come in with existing concerns around loss of muscle mass, loss of bone mass, things like that they've heard about in the media, and pointing out that, like, hey, you are in a situation where weight loss would be very clearly beneficial for your health and longevity, and you are not terribly well trained, or you might be insufficiently active, you might have never trained at all, which applies to the broadest population that is pursuing or might be eligible for these kind of interventions. Most people don't train, especially resistance training, who would maybe qualify or benefit from the use of some of these treatments, for example. Or even if not, and they want to just, you know, they would benefit from weight loss independent of the use of medicines or surgery. And in that context, you know, getting them to begin physical activity in general, or resistance training in particular, can have huge benefits for them in maintaining at minimum their lean body mass, their muscle mass during this weight loss period. A fraction of them, just like we have elite, you know, freaky responders to training, you get somebody, you know, to start squatting and deadlifting, and a year and a half later, they're deadlifting 500. There's going to be some freaky responders here where, despite weight loss, whether on their own or with the use of medicines or surgery, if they train, maybe they can gain a fair amount of muscle mass. That would be your hyper responders. There's going to be the biggest fraction between who might be able to maintain. And then there's going to be a tiny fraction who might still lose some, but they might lose less than they would have otherwise. So basically all this is just the same, you know, training response bell curve that we see in all other contexts, just being shifted around based on what's the intervention that's happening. If the intervention is just straight aggressive, rapid, large deficit weight loss, like post-metabolic bariatric surgery, yeah, that curve is going to get shifted leftward pretty significantly, meaning like shifted down towards favoring more lean body mass loss. I can't really think of too many people who are going to get that surgery done, lose 50 kilos of body weight and without exercising and spontaneously gain lean body mass, right? So they have been shifted way down. But if you train, you might be able to push that curve rightward again to get some people to gain, a bunch of people to maintain, and many fewer people to lose significant lean body mass. So that's in the context of the weight loss interventions, medicine, surgeries, things like that. The other kind of like analogous, not exactly reflect, but an analogous situation that I deal with in practice where I have these conversations is in the context of bone mass, especially patients with osteopenia, osteoporosis, women who are perimenopause, postmenopause, or for whatever reason, maybe have their ovaries removed, et cetera. Any of these reasons, including some men who may have osteoporosis for various reasons. And it's a similar type of phenomenon. There's going to be some people who we get them training with or without, you know, additional medicines targeted towards treating osteoporosis who might be able to build and gain bone mass. There's going to be some who are going to be able to maintain. And if it's like, hey, we're maintaining where we're at over a longer period of time, I'm good with that. And there's going to be a fraction who, despite continued training, maybe their trajectory is still to lose a little bit of bone mass over time. I've had these conversations, and when, you know, mostly women that I'm having this conversation with are freaking out about their DEXA scans and their T scores and things like that. That's like the numbers going down, the numbers going down. And usually the conversation comes back to, well, it's probably going down less than it would if you weren't training at all. We can keep trying to experiment and find if there's something that you respond better to, if we want to augment things, but it's very likely going down less than it would otherwise. And more importantly than just the number, I have all this evidence that you are stronger, you have more muscle, you have more strength, you have more body control, you're less likely to fall, you're less likely to have the outcomes that you will feel. Like, you will feel if you fracture your hip, whereas you won't necessarily feel if your T-score goes down by 0.1 or 0.2 over the course of the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, right? And so that's like the big picture of how this applies in what I'll call kind of real world practice outside of, you know, elite strength and conditioning or powerlifting focused training, is this same bell curve of training response getting shifted around by all of these different interventions. And so if I could summarize all of this, when it comes to lean body mass as a category, including both muscle mass and bone mass, during periods of significant weight loss, on average, people are likely to lose some, but engaging in exercise in general and strength training in particular, you are way less likely to lose and more likely to maintain, and some people may even gain. So that's the strongest case that we can make, that during any period of weight loss, intentional, unintentional, or otherwise, if you can do some resistance exercise, you would be better off than not.
Yeah, fully agree. All right. Well, after a message from our sponsors here, we'll come back and we'll talk about what happens to VO2 max and cardiorespiratory fitness when you're on an energy deficit, and also how to
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. 2025 is here, which probably means you're reflecting on what you hope to achieve and perhaps even considering some New Year's resolutions. Learning a new language in 2025 with Rosetta Stone is a great goal, which comes with the added benefits of exploring new cultures, connecting more deeply with others, and oh, by the way, it's 50% off for life. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for the last 30 years, with millions of users in 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice quickly, along with the correct accent using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. And did I mention it's 50% off for life? Start the new year off with a resolution you can reach. There's no better time than right now to get started, and Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Head over to rosettastone.com/today and get 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Again, it's 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up, and according to the 2022 Annual Data Breach Report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the US in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets. Guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Brain went in a calorie deficit. All right, we're back here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast with Dr. Austin Baraki. Let's talk about what happens when you're in an energy deficit and how that affects cardiorespiratory fitness. So this is most often measured by VO2 max, which describes a person's maximum ability to take in, transport, and use oxygen during exercise. This is sometimes known as a person's maximum aerobic capacity. A somewhat related measure is oxygen pulse, which refers to the amount of oxygen used by each beat of the heart. Now, oxygen pulse is determined by multiplying the heart's stroke volume by the arteriovenous oxygen difference during exercise. And I know you listen at home, you're like, dude, what are you talking about? Well, the heart's stroke volume is how much blood is pumped out of the heart per beat. And the arteriovenous oxygen gradient is a measurement of how much oxygen is dumped off at the muscle. In other words, it's the difference in oxygen content between the artery and the vein, with the capillary being in between. And that's where the oxygen is offloaded to the muscle. Now, with weight loss, so you're an energy deficit, it produces weight loss. Well, cardiac mass, so the actual mass of the heart, tends to decrease as it is related to body size. This can reduce the size of the left ventricle and subsequently how much blood is pumped out of it. Also, a loss of lean body mass when it occurs means that there's less oxygen-hungry muscle tissue available to create as big of a gradient between the artery and the vein. Together, both may contribute to decreasing oxygen pulse and VO2 max with weight loss, since less oxygen is being consumed. However, this may be eliminated when correcting for total fat-free mass. So what we're talking about here is when studies are looking at VO2 max between individuals who are eating at an energy maintenance versus eating an energy deficit and producing weight loss, sometimes you'll see no change in VO2 max, their maximum absolute level of oxygen sort of consumption during exercise. However, their relative VO2 max when corrected for total fat-free mass should go up if they're becoming more fit, okay? Because again, you're trying to figure out, like, per kilo of tissue, how much oxygen can you consume? And if that's improving, you would predict that a person's cardiorespiratory fitness is also improving, even if their absolute level of sort of VO2 max isn't going up. That's some nuance there. That's another drinking game. So be careful, guys, be careful. But there is some nuance here. That's three. I'm so sorry. All right. So based on available data, people respond to conditioning exercise about the same in an energy deficit versus when being in an energy balance or surplus. Although again, the data is, I'm not going to say it, but you know what word is coming next. I'm not saying it because we've had too many. For example, this one study looked at folks who were doing about 4.5 hours of cardiorespiratory fitness exercise per week for 16 weeks while they were losing weight or while they were maintaining weight. So after 16 weeks and 7% weight loss, VO2 max decreased by 6% in the diet-only group. VO2 max and the absolute VO2 max stayed the same in those who were dieting and exercising, and it went up by 15% in the exercise-only group who did not lose weight. So that's the headline. But if you dig a bit deeper into the paper, the relative VO2 max, which is the VO2 max in this case based on body weight, went up by 5.7 in the exercise group and 3.1 in the diet plus exercise group. That's about the same because there's some measurement error in the test itself, and it did not change in the diet only group. This suggests a similarly sized increase in cardiorespiratory fitness. Again, there's way more nuance in the scaling of VO2 max to weight, with some evidence suggesting that using like VO2 max divided by body weight, that might be overly simplistic and result in a lot of errors. And so there should be this allometric scale that should be used. That's beyond the scope of this podcast, though. However, I did link to Neville et al.'s work. It's in the show notes if you want to read up more on that. Now, in another study, 73 premenopausal women with overweight were assigned to diet and aerobic training, diet and resistance training, or diet-only groups for a year. When looking at their relative VO2 max after this year, VO2 max basically stayed the same in the resistance training group and the group that didn't exercise. That's kind of what you would predict, but it went up in the aerobic training group, but they were only training for about 120 minutes per week, so not a huge gain in aerobic fitness, but it still went up. Again, suggesting that people preserve this physiological plasticity to respond to exercise. This is also shown in kids. They were on a high-protein, very low-carbohydrate diet of 800 calories per day. And I know what people are thinking at home. They're like, oh, my kid on an 800-calorie-per-day diet. What the heck? Yeah, well, this somehow got past the institutional review board. They did the study. And yeah, their relative VO2 max increased after 10 weeks based on their body weight changes. But their absolute VO2 max didn't go up. So again, when you read these studies on weight loss and its effect on VO2 max, you really have to kind of sort out the details here. So this preserved response to exercise is also borne out in performance. So things, measurements of aerobic capacity and the performance of competitive, elite, and world-class athletes. It seems that people can achieve and even maintain their performance in the face of an energy deficit. One study in elite Kenyan runners training just before a competition, they did this doubly labeled water study, basically measured how much energy that they were consuming over 7 days. They were in a negative energy balance by about 330 calories per day during this intense training period before a race. Their mileage was over 70 miles per week, but there were no reports of decreased performance. Rather, athletes said they weren't as hungry after workout. This has been called exercise-induced anorexia, but otherwise their actual performance was otherwise fine. And there's other sort of anecdotal evidence here. So for example, the 2004 London Marathon winner, Margaret Okeo from Kenya, she was the previous marathon world record holder. Well, she weighed in about 4 kilos less than her normal walking around weight when she won the gold medal. Again, suggesting that despite weight loss, people can seemingly perform very, very well. Also, just as an aside, a 39 kilo adult?
Yeah, the only 39 kilo adults that I've seen have been people that I've admitted to the hospital. So unclear on what's going on here.
Yeah. She's only 150 centimeters tall. So that, you know, relatively short, but still 39 kilos is also very, very light. Another study on 23 race walkers, well, they did 3 weeks of major energy reduction. So their maintenance sort of calories were 3,600 calories per day. And then they went down to 2,100 calories per day. And then they tested themselves on a 10K race walk. So they did one before the sort of deficit and one afterwards. Well, they, despite losing 2 kilos, about 1.6 of that was actual fat mass, there were no changes in their performance. So despite losing weight and being on a massive calorie deficit, far bigger than what we're advocating for, their performance didn't actually go down. And then finally, in another study on male, middle, and long distance runners, they were using the sort of intermittent fasting approach versus just continuing at maintenance calories. Well, the people on intermittent fasting group, they lost about 2 kilos, but the performance was the same after about 8 weeks. So the major takeaway, our fourth recommendation, individuals can improve cardiorespiratory fitness and performance during an energy deficit. Improvements do not appear to be smaller when compared to being in an energy balance. Again, physiological plasticity seems to be maintained.
Yeah, this is the one that's easiest for me to, you know, understand from my own prior experience training in the context of swimming with a lot of my teammates who, and sometimes even myself, who'd come back from a summer of not training very hard, potentially participating in other activities that would lead to some weight gain or whatever the case is. And then, you know, a lot of the guys would lose a bunch of pounds early in the season, get pretty shredded, get way fitter, way faster, and then be ready to race come, you know, February timeframe when championship meet season and things like that. So I saw this all the time every year where people would improve dramatically despite sometimes a more significant amount of weight loss each season.
Yeah. And just a brief sort of word on, like, you know, relative magnitude of energy deficit. There are kind of two specialized terms that you'll see throw around in the exercise science literature if you decide to pursue that and go look at it. You'll see these two terms: low energy availability, also abbreviated as LEA, and the relative energy deficiency in sport, REDS. We've talked about that in one of our case reports and a few other times on the podcast. Now, when people are losing weight, okay, they're in, by definition, some sort of low energy availability sort of state. It's just a relatively small amount of low energy availability, so a relative LEA state. And to actually meet criteria for low energy availability, there's this definition that you have to be eating less than 30 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass. I don't know anybody that really knows their fat-free mass level to the, you know, nearest kilo. And I also don't know people that are really tracking their calories that closely to sort of ascertain this information. So
yeah, it feels more like a research definition than like a pragmatic kind of guide for people.
That said, there's, like, you know, there's this big sort of to-do in sports right now about people who might be at risk for, you know, severe low energy availability, which is, you know, the risk is REDS in that particular case. And there's some controversy over that right now, but there's two questionnaires. One is called the LEAM, that's low energy availability for men questionnaire. And then there's one low energy availability in females questionnaire. I've linked both of those in the show notes below, so you can read up on those. And if you're worried about an athlete or someone you're working with, maybe not eating enough and suffering from low energy availability, and you're sort of worried about the risk of progression to REDS, that might be useful. That said, it just brings up this broader concept of, like, the main sort of deficits you would see in somebody's training response and training outcomes has to do with the magnitude of the deficit. So how big, how many calories less are they eating, and the duration, right? So if we're talking about a 200 calorie per day deficit that goes on for months, not really worried about that. As far as its impact on strength gain, I think it's going to be about the same. Muscle mass gain, probably less than if someone's in a surplus, but I still suspect some sort of response there. Or VO2 max sort of improvement, cardiorespiratory fitness improvement, I expect that's going to be about the same. If it was a 1500 calorie per day deficit, so now we're worried about maybe like frank malnourishment and mineral deficiency and so on, well, that's a different story, and particularly if that goes on for maybe a year, for example. And so there are just levels to this. And so I don't want people to conflate what happens with, like, a very severe energy restriction going on for a prolonged period of time where with a more modest sort of reduction that goes on for a shorter period of time. You happy with that sort of caveat here?
Yeah, content with it. That's good.
Cool. All right, well, let's get into the meat and potatoes here, or the tofu and the asparagus for our plant-based folks. The practical application here. Okay, so how do you actually program and train for weight loss? And we'll start with the dietary component here, okay? Because obviously, if we're favoring dietary interventions to produce weight loss, we can't very well just go on and not talk about that any further. So generally speaking, we would recommend a modest deficit, which again has no, like, consensus definition, but we would recommend somewhere in the 200 to 500 calorie per day deficit range. Again, if you want to find your maintenance calories, we have a calorie calculator on our website. You could also use the NIH bodyweight planner. They're all good, just using slightly different formulas. So a modest deficit would be our first recommendation to produce a relatively slow rate of weight loss. And again, this is for folks who are very performance minded. They're trying to get the most out of their training. For people who are looking to maximize health in response to, like, I'm carrying too much body fat, I would like to lose some body fat, this is not really a consideration. Unless, again, the exercise for whatever reason and performance is highly motivating to them, there's some maybe positive feedback there. Would also recommend against a low carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic diet, again, for these performance-minded folks. data set after data set after data set keeps coming out showing that a lower carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic dietary approach tends to reduce strength gain in response to training, tends to reduce muscle mass. That's probably better data on that, and certainly cardiorespiratory fitness performance. So if I had to choose a dietary pattern, it would probably not be a low carbohydrate or a ketogenic diet when I'm trying to maximize performance, particularly in an energy deficit. And also it would not be low in protein. I can think of few things that would maybe be worse for muscle mass, for strength, for endurance performance than a calorie deficit, particularly if it's large and it's low in protein. That'd be a really good recipe for losing muscle mass and losing performance. Maybe tack on some sort of chronic disease that just popped up out of nowhere. Yeah, that would be problematic. And then to do that, we already mentioned this earlier, would recommend altering the food environment to the extent that's possible. So whatever's in your home, whatever's in your office, and also modifying the eating environment. So literally where you eat your food. Would recommend having some sort of schedule that you eat at relatively similar times day to day, ideally sitting down, distraction free. So no phone, no TV, no computer. Ideally you're with friends or family. And again, you can be more engaged in the meal that way rather than being distracted. And I don't need to belabor the point about losing fast, losing weight quickly versus losing weight slowly. I think we've covered all of that. There's ample data here to suggest that people on average either preserve more muscle mass or actually gain more muscle mass with a slow approach. Same thing with strength improvements. People tend to either preserve their strength better or improve their strength better with a slow, more moderate approach. And you see the same thing with the endurance performance when it's actually tested on a particular sort of event.
Can I add one caveat before we get into training?
Nope.
particularly around the fast versus slow, just to reiterate 2 points. So the first is you mentioned this idea of a modest deficit, and you gave some parameters of like maybe what type of a calorie deficit that could be and these calculators. And that is by no means to imply that, you know, the best way or the universal way is for people to calculate calorie needs and things like that. That is a way to get an estimate of, you know, what these what the size of this deficit, what these parameters could look like. But this is not recommending that everybody, broadly speaking, you know, be counting, tracking, weighing, measuring calories. There's a lot of different ways that you can go about generating a calorie deficit. Although I've not been in a situation where I've deliberately tried to lose large amounts of body fat, I have at various times, as have you, manipulated our body weight in various directions. And during none of those times have I ever weighed and tracked and measured calories. As we've talked about before, I tend to have generally more similar eating patterns day to day than not. And based on how I tend to auto kind of regulate, monitor my weight day to day, I will just make modest adjustments to my meals as a way to bump them up in calories if I want to gain a little bit of weight, or bump them back down if I want to take it in the other direction. And none of that involves dedicated weighing and measuring, but that is a tool if you're like, I have no idea what I'm even talking about, what amount of calories is in a given portion of a food item that I'm consuming.
Yep.
The second thing, oh, go ahead.
No, it's kind of like a layered approach, right? So let's just say that your stock breakfast, your default breakfast for whatever reason is, 6 eggs, 4 whites, 2 yolks, a cup of oatmeal, a tablespoon of peanut butter, and 2 pieces of fruit. That's your default breakfast. I know that's not your default breakfast, but let's just say that it is. In a time where you were trying to lose body weight, you might alter that. Okay, I'm going to remove the peanut butter. I'm going to do all egg whites, for example. And all you've done is kind of remove a layer from that particular meal. And if you do that across all meals and you're able to maintain that, great. Now, people who can do that, that's another approach. It is not the approach, but it's just an approach that can work. Same thing with like if people prefer calorie targets or macro targets and want to weigh and measure, that's all fine. But there are many different ways to do this. It's just an approach that can be used.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to mention is in the context of fast versus slow weight loss, less oriented around performance, because the other thing that I could see some people taking away is like, yes, we care about performance, we care about strength and muscle mass, therefore like slow weight loss is always the move. And I would say that's definitely not the case. So there are going to be several health related situations where I would say more rapid weight loss would be, you know, to the person's benefit, and then we can build the strength and the muscle mass later, and that's okay, especially for somebody who has, for example, been very recently diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. There is a relatively small window where you can strike and you can put the diabetes into remission. If you lose a significant amount of fat mass quickly early on, you can put it into remission and not necessarily need long-term treatments or medicines or anything like that for diabetes. That'd be a situation where I'm like, no, we're doing this quick. and aggressively, and I may even use some medicines early on to accelerate the weight loss with the hope that, hey, if I can restore healthy, you know, beta cell function and things like that, I can get you off of these medicines and you can be in remission longer term. Somebody whose physical activity is limited due to, you know, the mechanical effects of body fat, or who has severe, you know, painful knee osteoarthritis or joint, you know, things like, I'm going to say, let's try to get this off quicker, put this pain, you know, either into remission or improve it dramatically. And then we can engage in more, you know, dedicated performance oriented activity if that's something that interests you later on, or various cardiovascular conditions, fatty liver disease, et cetera, things like that. So in the context of most medical health conditions, comorbid diseases, complications thereof, I'm more often leaning towards rapid weight loss if I can achieve it. Whereas in situations where those are not really considerations and the person has a justifiable reason to care about their performance in the, let's say, near to medium term, then I think that the slower term weight loss makes a lot more sense in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think in most medical cases, the risks of not getting enough body weight, body fat in particular, off in a reasonable amount of time, that's far more riskier than the potential benefits of going slower and preserving more muscle mass. Individuals with obesity, by and large, have far more muscle mass than those individuals without obesity. So I'm not really worried about, like, sarcopenia, for example, in somebody with obesity. Shout out to...
Yeah, this is a teaser for our general audience. We did a hot takes episode on the subscriber feed discussing, I think it was Dr. Gabrielle Lyon's take, that most people are not don't carry too much body fat. They're just under-muscled, and we tore that apart, I think, in sufficient detail. So subscribe to check that out, I suppose.
There you go. All right, well, let's talk about training now. Okay, so I'm going to address this piecemeal. We'll talk about conditioning-specific considerations and then also lifting-specific considerations. So we'll start with conditioning. And again, should be no surprise to anyone who's listened to the Barbell Medicine podcast for any period of time that we want everyone who's able to at least meet the current physical activity guidelines for conditioning. It's about 2.5 hours per week of moderate to vigorous cardiorespiratory fitness activity, so cardio or endurance training. You could also do 75 minutes per week of vigorous intensity cardio exercise, or combine the two to otherwise achieve, as the guidelines say, 500 to 1,000 MET minutes per week. Now, that's a whole bunch of jargon. Basically, it's doing 20 minutes per day of cardio or some semblance of that. Starting there and achieving that is like my primary goal for folks who are currently inactive or insufficiently active. Then from there, people can add more if they want. Although, again, I refer you back to the beginning of this podcast, I do not think that tends to have as much of an effect on long-term sustainable weight loss for most folks. Now, I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, or at least I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth. The problem here is that by increasing exercise, again, people tend to compensate more for that as when it gets above a certain amount, meaning that people will burn less calories doing other stuff. They'll move less when they're not exercising. Their other metabolic processes cost less, take up less energy, or whatever. That's the sort of chronic effect of adding more exercise. And we're talking about 6 months, 8 months, 12 months, 24 months, 5 years down the road. It's just not a sort of great move for this sort of long-term sustained weight loss. But in the short term, because people are like, well, what about bodybuilders? They just add cardio and they lose more body fat. It's like, well, that's a different story. And so if we're just talking about losing as much body fat as possible in the next 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, 16 weeks, yes, absolutely. Increasing exercise, particularly from conditioning, can have a substantial effect, particularly if it's done in a way that doesn't really impact how much weight training you're doing and is programmed intelligently. That said, that is not a sustainable sort of approach for people who are looking to lose body fat and then keep it off indefinitely, which is why bodybuilders don't do that. Bodybuilders, they get ready for a show, they do the show, and then return to some sort of more modest sort of or more moderate body composition, which is not generally stage lean unless there are other things going on, whether it's polypharmacy, whether it's great genetics, whether it's both. Can't, you know, up for debate, maybe for another podcast. But the takeaway from this here is that I want people to at least achieve the guidelines for conditioning exercise. So again, about 150 minutes per week of moderate to vigorous activity and or 75 minutes of vigorous intensity conditioning exercise. You can combine those two together. And once you get there, to me, that's checking the box. You want to add a little bit more, because there's more health benefits, yes, I am 100% behind that. In fact, if I was writing the exercise guidelines, I'd probably double the sort of target, or at least make some sort of objective VO2 max target or improvement in fitness as sort of a goal in there that could be monitored. But I just don't think that it's going to do much for weight loss proper. Do you kind of agree with that, or do you have a disagreement that we could publish on air?
Yeah, I think in practice, it almost matters a bit less what I think in that situation. And it comes down to more my conversation with the person. And if the person, the rare specimen who is just like itching to do more activity, I'm like, sure. I'm certainly not going to pull the reins back on them and say, nah, I wouldn't increase this because it's, you know, on population level data, less likely to be effective over the 5-year time span. That's like a horrible way to have a conversation with a patient anyway, but that's not going to be the way that conversation goes. And so more often it's a battle to get the person up to meeting those minimums. If we can get them there, that's great. And if from there, if they're like, man, I feel great, I can find myself easily doing more, it's like, cool, send it. That's fine. That might not be enough on its own, or that might not be the entirety of our intervention, but I'm not gonna hold you back. It's just that if I get you there and you're like, this is a fair amount of work, I don't know how interested I am in doing more, I'm like, okay, like I'm not going to push and push and push and push and say, you know, you're not going to succeed unless we can get you, you know, tripling the guidelines or something like that. So that's the way it ends up playing out more in practice.
Yeah. The only other consideration I have here is that if somebody becomes very motivated to lose weight, for example, right, but they're also very performance minded from a strength perspective, right? I think one of the ways that people can set themselves up for failure is that they enter a pretty aggressive energy deficit. They add in a bunch of cardio at the same time, and they're like, why are my strength numbers going down? And it's like, well, that amount of concurrent training, so combining both resistance training and conditioning together, well, you're just not prepared for that amount of training load. And so you're kind of just fighting to keep your head above water until you can adapt to that. Plus, you've also added a layer of stress with the energy deficit. And so
yeah, that decline in strength performance may well have happened even if you were at maintenance, because you might be doing too much too soon, which is ill-advised in most situations.
Yeah. So for the person, if you're listening to this right now and you're like, look, hey, it is the beginning of the new year. You captured me. Good job with the SEO. And you're not doing a lot of conditioning, or maybe even any conditioning right now. You're just lifting a few times a week. Hey, that's great. I would recommend trying to work your way up to the current physical activity guidelines. Again, 150 minutes per week, 2.5 hours per week of moderate intensity, continuous training over a period of about a month. So if you start at 20 minutes three times a week, and then you add a couple minutes, 5 minutes each week, get up there over time. I think by the end of a month, 4 to 6 weeks, something like that, that would be my sort of on-ramp into sort of meeting the guidelines, see how you do. If you're already meeting those and you're like, no, but I still want to lose some weight, you can add more if you want. But I do think the bigger lever to pull, as we mentioned in the beginning, is going to be the dietary component of energy restriction. All right, let's move on to lifting point. Yeah, fine. Look, we're on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Finally get to talk about barbells. Dang it. Hour in. Sorry about that. This is kind of like the easiest part of the podcast, because I actually don't think that lifting should change much when people are trying to pursue weight loss. There's sort of caveats here are as follows. If somebody is looking to lose weight because they're burnt out on training, right? Maybe they were like just singularly focused on strength improvement. And for whatever reason, things have gone sideways. They're not really enjoying their training. They're like, you know what? I'm going to take a break from this. I want to lose weight. I want to get in better shape. You know, maybe that means more cardiorespiratory fitness improvement. And I want to lose a little bit of weight. Okay, cool. Change your whole program. If your goals have changed, well, the programming has to change to support that. But if your goals are still the same, you still want to be strong. You just want to weigh a little bit less, have a little bit less body fat. Then I think if the program was working before, why I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't mess with it just because you're in a modest energy deficit. And this is especially true for folks who are in like a weight class sport. If you are a competitive powerlifter, Olympic weightlifter, strongman competitor, although the weight classes are a little bit different for that, I wouldn't change your training if you were training for that before. In general, my recommendation for weight class athletes is to maintain somewhere within 5% of your sort of target weight year round, because larger sort of weight losses than that have been continuously associated with reductions in performance. Of course, it does matter, you know, how long do you have between your weigh-in and when you have to compete? There's some difference there, but I think as a general recommendation, being, you know, within 5%, 3 to 5% of your weight target is reasonable. But otherwise, I don't know that your lifting has to change goals unless you're changing your goals yourself. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that one of the more common things we've heard over the years is this idea that once you go into a calorie deficit, that, yeah, the way your training should be set up changes pretty dramatically. And we've seen people who've gone from, you know, maybe a moderate volume or a high volume program, or what is otherwise maybe a reasonable program that we're responding well to a super low volume program at super high intensities, because they think that because of a, you know, 500 calorie deficit, they won't be able to handle the training volume. And they're under the misguided impression that, you know, just doing like a set to failure is going to be like the best way to, you know, maintain as much of their gains as possible.
And without costing too much in recovery. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, maybe I'm not saying this always happens, but I've seen this happen before where sometimes along the way they'll, you know, start to have some pain, develop an injury, and they're like, it was because of the calorie deficit. And it's like, well, you change your training up quite a bit and are like training to near failure all the time, which is also not often a great idea when it comes to, you know, reducing the risk of, you know, experiencing pain, overuse syndromes and things like that. So I agree that, you know, the tendency or this idea, wherever it's came from, that calorie deficit means you should go super low volume, high intensity, would not recommend on average. If there's something that you have identified that you respond well to, I also wouldn't change very much until you have a strong reason to pivot from there. I'll, you know, allude back to what I mentioned earlier, as far as just like all of these interventions are shifting the bell curve around a bit, right? If you have a program that you have responded very well to and you're on like the far right end of the bell curve of your response to that training program, maybe with a sufficiently high calorie deficit over a sufficiently high amount of time, maybe that would shift your curve leftward a little bit, or shift you down the curve a little bit so you don't respond quite as well. But you're probably still responding better to that than you might to something else if you've already identified it. So I would not make a ton of preemptive changes to training just because you have maybe shifted into a deficit, as long as there's some component of autoregulation involved in the training, meaning that you can use something like RPE or reps in reserve, or you have percentage, you know, ranges in your training, or some method to let you say, hey, today's a good day, I'm going to take advantage of it, I feel good to go a little heavier today, I'm not doing so hot, it's okay for me to pull back on the load a little bit, I don't need to like force a particular weight if it's not there on this day. Just being a bit more, you know, gentle with yourself in that situation is a good idea.
Yeah, I could also envision a scenario like where somebody's under the pretense that if you're in an energy deficit, you're trying to lose weight, that it makes no sense to train for strength, right? It makes no sense to train for strength, makes no sense to train for muscle size. So I just want to spend as little amount of time in the gym as possible. So those two beliefs aren't really true, but if you are otherwise limited on time, and maybe that's the reason why you're sort of leaning towards a weight loss period. Look, you can get away with a reduction in sort of training volume and total training load for a pretty long period of time without seeing a severe sort of drop off in performance. Yes, you're likely to lose a little bit of strength, or at least achieve less strength improvement than you otherwise would if you were training more. Same thing for muscle mass. You're likely to preserve a bunch of it, but maybe not as much as if you were training more, or certainly not gaining as much. Same thing for VO2 max. We predict that your VO2 max would sort of hang on or maybe even improve a little bit, but not as much as if you were training more. There are no free lunches here in biology. So if you can train more, you're likely to get a better sort of response. But if you're sort of combination of limited time, limited motivation, and you're like, well, we'll lose some weight while we're at it, you can get away with a sort of smaller training dose. I just wouldn't take all those sets to failure. That would not be my approach. Oh, just jack the intensity up, reduce the volume. So that would not be my recommendation. So for my recommendation, if someone's untrained right now, I think our beginner prescription or the beginner template, fine place to start. There are many others like that on the internet that you can find as well. If you're a trained individual and you're looking for some sort of recommendations, well, here you go. If you are a strength-focused individual and you prefer full body training sessions, our low fatigue template has a number of iterations that it comes with it, 4 different programs, 3 days, 4 days, some slight variations there that can be useful. If you like strength and size combined together, maybe equal priorities, and full body sessions, our power building template line suited for you right there. If you are more size focused and you also prefer full body training sessions, our hypertrophy template line suits you there. if you're size focused but prefer a body part split approach. That's our bodybuilding template line. And then finally, if you're like, I kind of just want strength and some conditioning and I do like a body part split, our general strength conditioning template series would be appropriate for you. So there's no real specific sort of training intervention that I would use for weight loss per se. Rather, I would just want to, again, do the same thing I would normally do. What are your goals? What are your preferences? What have you responded to historically to kind of get me in the right ballpark, and then see how somebody does and adjust over time?
Yeah, that's why there's no weight loss template.
Can you imagine? Just did like get ripped for summer. Ethically, you would just quit. That's the thing. And so I can't. I like you too much. Our friendship's too important. I can't do that. All right, let's summarize this little parting shot. For years, many in the health and fitness space have warned that energy deficits are like kryptonite to athletes and those who take their training seriously. The standard playbook says insufficient calories throw hormones into chaos, derail normal body functions, and tank athletic performance. It's a neat, logical theory, but there's just one problem. It's not based in reality. Research keeps turning up cases that defy this conventional wisdom. Athletes with chronic energy deficits aren't just surviving, they're thriving, competing at international levels, and sometimes even improving their performance. It's like watching someone build a skyscraper while running low on construction materials. But here's where it gets tricky. We're not saying that energy deficits are superior to eating at maintenance or eating a surplus for outcomes like strength, muscle size, or endurance. It's more like a double-edged sword. The impact of a calorie deficit depends entirely on the size of the deficit. Think of it as the difference between dimming your lights to save power versus cutting off the electricity entirely. Small deficits and modest weight loss seem to have little effect on strength and endurance improvement, though the muscle mass gains are almost certain to be less when compared to an energy surplus or eating at maintenance. Larger deficits sustained for longer periods of time are more likely to be detrimental. Still, this should be reassuring for those who want to lose weight but who want to maintain their gains. We recommend a modest deficit of about 250 to 500 calories per day and slow, sustained weight loss. Now, there's one crucial caveat here. There's two crucial caveats here, though: carbohydrates and protein. While the body can adapt to general energy deficits, severely restricting carbohydrates or protein is like trying to run a Tesla on half its batteries. It doesn't just hurt immediate performance, it can hamstring your ability to adapt to training over time. So we would not recommend a low or very low carbohydrate diet for folks who want to maximize their training while losing weight, and we wouldn't recommend a low protein diet either. In fact, we recommend a minimum of about 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, though hard training individuals or those who prefer a higher protein diet can certainly consume more. Perhaps the most important revelation is that athletic performance makes a terrible canary in the coal mine for low energy availability or relative energy deficiency syndrome in sport. The body is remarkably stubborn about maintaining physical capacity. This is why watching for drops in performance isn't sufficient for diagnosing these conditions. Again, more rapid weight loss is typically an appropriate first priority for those with medical complications from excess body fat, such as diabetes, fatty liver disease, and cardiovascular disease, among others. But overall, the relationship between energy availability and athletic performance isn't the simple equation that we once thought. It's more like a complex balancing act where the body makes sophisticated trade-offs and we're only beginning to understand it. Austin, anything you want to add to my Jerry's Corner?
No, I think that's a decent summation of a lot of data. Nice job putting it all together. Hopefully it's useful for folks who are either kicking off their training in the new year or pivoting their training in some way, or, you know, if they anticipate anything like this becoming relevant to them on the horizon. So we're looking forward to having some additional how to train for various particular goal podcasts coming up soon.
Yeah, very excited. Notice his inflection.
Hey, post I got COVID in the past week, still recovering. Give me a break.
Yeah, in addition to recovering from COVID being an immediate goal, any training goals for 2025?
Yeah, so in the past few weeks to months, I was having a bit of some hip some aches in the area that I've actually think I've got put to bed within the past 2 weeks. I haven't really felt much of anything, and so I think I'm going to be ready to ramp things back up at a seemingly appropriate time. So hopefully by this point next year, I'm in a very different spot. And what I'm anticipating is, even though it's something I've done a fair amount of in the past over my training career, it's something that is obviously more popular these days. Some sort of combination strength and conditioning or quote unquote hybrid goal may even emerge over this year. I've had some suggestions given in the comments on my most recent Instagram post for either some weird lift conditioning PR type thing. But yeah, so I could see myself pursuing, if not one rep max, you know, PRs in the power lifts, some sort of a mile 5K PR combined with a, you know, bench dead push pull, like bench deadlift PR, something in that vein. It's still kind of crystallizing for me based on how things feel in the coming weeks and where my head's at moving forward. But that's kind of what I would like to pursue over the course of the next few months and potentially by the end of the year. What about you?
I mean, it seems when you say it, it just, I like how open-ended it is. I like how it's different than what you've done before.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I'm just doing the same thing. I have these delusions of grandeur about being a high level power lifter. And I still like the lifts. I still like training for it. I'm reasonably healthy. Yeah. I'm going to turn 40.
I support it. I mean, I enjoy the lifts and training for them. And if I could choose and snap my fingers and be like at peak strength in them, sure, that's great. I think that one of the differences is your both interest and particular goals in the competitive realm. Whereas like getting on a powerlifting platform at this point, especially, not that it ever did a ton, but at this point, like it does nothing for me. Whereas you still have some interests, some motivations, some goals, some friendly rivalries, or maybe some unfriendly rivalries that keep you going. And so I think that that's a great reason, you know, to keep the fire lit for that goal. But you've even had your own times where you pivoted to more motocross or golf, or maybe come up with some weird hybrid moto golf deadlift.
If I keep refining the categories enough, I'll be the best in the world.
There you go.
just enough caveats. All right. Well, that is a wrap here on our How to Train for Weight Loss episode. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining us on the podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all of this nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine podcast.
Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.